Welcome to the Federalist Society Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Labor and Employment Law Practice Group, was recorded on Thursday, March 21st, 2013, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Federalist Society Practice Group telephone conference call as we continue our special series of calls focusing on the National Labor Relations Board. Today, we're going to be discussing the posting regs of the NLRB. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for possible use as a podcast in the future. We're going to hear opening remarks from each of our experts of about 5 to 10 minutes, followed by your questions. We'll hear first from Mr. Maurice Baskin, followed by Mr. Walter Kamiot. Maurice Baskin is a partner at the Venable Law Firm in its Labor and Employment Law Practice Group. There, he focuses on all aspects of labor and employment law representing management. Walter Kamiot is the Associate General Counsel of the Service Employees International Union, a position he has held since 2004. He is SEIU's principal counsel in the home care area, where the SEIU represents over 500,000 workers. Their longer bios, more complete bios, are available on our website, so we're going to get right to the discussion today. And with that, Mr. Baskin, please go right ahead with your opening remarks.
All right. Thanks very much. Welcome, everyone, and welcome, Mr. Kamiot. Thanks for participating in this today. This challenged rule that we're talking about today, it's as mentioned, a notice posting requirement issued by the National Labor Relations Board, and for the first time in the 77-year history of the National Labor Relations Act, it would force some 6 million employers around the country, 6 million, to post a notice to their employees about their rights to unionize and engage in other group activities, even though none of these employers has been found to have done anything to interfere with their employees' rights under the Act, and nor have the employers been the subject of a union election petition to provoke this requirement. Now, obviously, not everyone on this call is a labor lawyer, so you probably need to know a little something about the unique structure of the National Labor Relations Board and just a brief chronology to, by way of background, to know how we got here and why this is such a big deal to the business community. I'm going to cover 77 years in a minute here, but the National Labor Relations Act was passed in 1935. I only mention that because it contains no provision authorizing the National Labor Relations Board to require employers to post any notices, even though just the year before that, the Railway Labor Act was passed with a notice posting provision. Since then, until now, the board has never attempted to impose a notice posting requirement, anything like what is present here. The only time the board has required notices to be posted has been to remedy unfair labor practices that have been brought before it, or in the context of a union organizing petition, which has been brought before it. And in fact, that's a key part of the National Labor Relations Act when it was passed. And it's been pretty much conceded by the board that the board itself was created as a reactive agency. It is not a roving commission. It's not like most other federal labor agencies, which have the right to go out and investigate on their own and find violations and determine that something should be changed in the workplace, such as with wage and hour laws and discrimination laws. The board does not have any such authority. The board's authority is limited by certain provisions of the Act that we'll be talking about the rest of the day. It was the product of a compromise to be a buffer, essentially, between organized labor and management back in the 30s, and that principle has never changed. In fact, in 1947, Congress passed the Taft-Hartley Act in order to restrict the board's actions towards employers in particular. Further, and we'll come back to that, Section 8C of the Act was put in place to say, in the Taft-Hartley Act, to say that the board should not regulate employer communications with their employees. which is exactly what this notice poster requirement does. Well, bringing it into the present or the near present, the board engaged in a rulemaking proceeding. It started in late 2010 and issued this final rule requiring the new notice to be posted in August 2011. It was issued by a 3-to-1 vote. Shortly thereafter, within weeks, multiple lawsuits were filed in federal courts, both here in the District of Columbia and in South Carolina, different business plaintiff coalitions representing virtually every industry covered by the act. There was really a groundswell of opposition to it as employers saw this as an unprecedented invasion of their businesses and outside the authority of the board, as it had been previously understood. So the suits were filed in March 2012. An Obama appointee, Judge Jackson, federal judge in the district, upheld the board's right to require employers to post the notice, but then struck down parts of the rule that made the failure to post an unfair labor practice, or that extended the statute of limitations under the act. So partial victory for the board in that decision. But immediately thereafter, Chief Judge Norton of the District Court in South Carolina, an appointee of Bush 41, struck down the entire notice posting rule on the ground that the rule exceeded the authority delegated to the board by Congress. And then on also in April, right after that, an appeal was filed with the D.C. Circuit, which issued a temporary stay pending their ruling on the merits of the appeal from Judge Jackson's decision. I actually filed that appeal. I should say, I don't know if it was mentioned, I'm not here representing anyone today, though obviously I was involved in the actual litigation and the argument of the appeal in the D.C. Circuit, which took place in September of 2012. No decision has been issued yet in that case. In the meantime, I think you've had a presentation about the Noel Canning decision that came out January of this year, declaring some appointments to the NLRB to be unconstitutional. That had an indirect impact on one of the members of the board who decided this rule. We can talk more about what impact, if any, there is from the Noel Canning decision, but it should be mentioned that there was a quorum of confirmed members who made the original decision back in August 2011 to promulgate the rule. There was an issue raised at a certain point in the district court about the potential unconstitutional recess appointments when it came to implementing this rule. That was not presented on appeal to the D.C. Circuit, and so that's basically where it stands at the moment. And last but not least, on March 19th, this very week, argument was held in the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals on the board's appeal from the South Carolina decision on this same notice poster rule. Bottom line is the rule is not currently in effect pending the outcome of these two different appeals and then ultimately whether it also goes to the Supreme Court. So that's how we got to where we are. I should say a few words about why the business community thinks it really is a big deal and why it has been challenged. As I mentioned, it really has to do with the authority of the board. Does the National Labor Relations Act give the board, which has been held numerous times to be a reactive agency only, does it give the board the authority to require employers who have done nothing to their employees, have not been accused of violating the act in any way, and have not been the subject of a union election petition? Does the board have the power to impose this new affirmative duty on them to communicate with their employees in the workplace? Obviously, the business community says no and has argued this based on the structure of the labor law, the National Labor Relations Act, the language of the act, and the legislative history of the act, which would submit unambiguously prohibits the board from imposing this type of affirmative obligation on employers who have otherwise done nothing wrong. I don't know whether it pays to go into a lot more detail about that. I think it will come out in our back and forth discussion. I will say that what we have seen argued by the board is that their rulemaking power somehow gives them authority that they have been denied in the case-by-case adjudication process over many decades. The Supreme Court has repeatedly said that the Labor Board, unlike other types of agencies, doesn't have the power to impose punitive penalties on companies. It is only supposed to make people whole, to remedy actions that have, where companies have done something wrong. And what's happened here, and a major reason why this rule has been challenged and I think will be ultimately overturned permanently, is that it reaches out and imposes obligations on employers that have done nothing wrong. It forces them to communicate with their employees in ways that they are not required to do, and in fact, that the board is prohibited from doing under Section 8C of the Act. And I think with that, because I've kind of overdone my time on the introduction to get all of this set up, I think I'll turn it over to Mr. Kamiat, and then we'll have some back and forth in response to questions and be able to address other issues, of which there are quite a number.
Thank you very much. I want to thank the Federal Society and Mr. Baskin for the opportunity. Union side labor lawyers aren't normal attendees at Federalist Society events, and I thank you very much for the opportunity. Obviously, I have a very, very different perspective. Let me just, I guess, briefly give some reactions to what Mr. Baskin has said, because I think we have a very different perspective, and then go into what I think is the affirmative case for what's been done. First, the premise here is that that there's something untoward about exercising rulemaking authority with respect to authority, with respect to doing something that you wouldn't have the authority to do without the rulemaking authority. And it kind of, to me, says that what's rulemaking authority for? The giving an agency rulemaking authority is an affirmative grant of a power, and it may be a limited power, and we can talk about what the limits are, but it seems to me a strange argument, and I'll go into it a little bit further, to say that because you couldn't do it without rulemaking authority, you can't do it with rulemaking authority. Second, and I'll go back to all of these points, but just to kind of clear the deck a little. Second, the notion that the board, this is unprecedented, the board has never done it. And there's some truth to that. The board, unique among agencies, has not historically used its rulemaking authority, which dates from the original Act in 1935, and has been wildly criticized for that fact by judges, by the U.S. Supreme Court, by scholars, saying that it has had a practice of announcing prospective rules through their adjudications that has an element of unfairness to it, and that it should, as a better practice, utilize this rulemaking authority it was given to announce prospective rules, which would then be evaluated as rules normally are in the rulemaking process and the administrative law associated with that. And that's really what it did here. So there is an irony to attacking it for the unprecedented use of its very underused authority under NLRA Section 6, which is the rulemaking provision, when it was doing so in response to widespread criticism that it had underutilized that authority and tried to do the prospective rulemaking in an indirect way. And then again, the assertion that that this is requiring employers who have done nothing wrong to do something which has never been done before. Well, that I don't think is really true either, because it has announced prospective norms of behavior that are binding on employers in its adjudications since the founding of the Act. And it has said, you know, we are, you know, if you're faced with this situation, you must do this. If faced with that situation, you must do that. In certain circumstances, you must do this, you must do that. And that has been the basis of adjudications under the Act. Now, it's true that there is no enforcement procedure against employers for failing to do either for doing prohibited acts or for failing to do affirmatively required acts in the absence of a charge under the ULP provisions, the unfair labor practice provisions, or in the absence of a representation petition. He's absolutely right in that. But that is equally true here. There is no provision in this rule that says that the agency will act as a roving commission to investigate whether people are or not posting this notice. It is saying that the failure to post notice will be treated as relevant, as a relevant fact in if a charge is brought but not otherwise, or if a representation petition is filed or not otherwise. So the reactive nature of the board's processes remains intact. Lastly, the comment that Mr. Baskin made about free speech rights of employers and how this is an affront to the free speech rights of employers. In the briefs, they go beyond the opponents of the rule go beyond Section 8C and talk about it in First Amendment constitutional terms, that this is an infringement on employers' First Amendment rights. Well, anybody who's ever worked for a living knows that if they go into the kitchen or lounge, there's a poster that says, here are your rights under this act or this act or this act or this act. This is no different than that. The NLRB is not asking employers to tell their employees anything. It's simply saying if you print off our website, there's a notice that you can stick on the wall, and it informs people of what their rights under this act are, just like all the other acts, and who you can call, just like all the other notices. If that's a First Amendment violation, then one of the most fundamental aspects of American administrative law is unconstitutional. Then the cigarettes you buy that have a required notice are unconstitutional. Then all those notices in the lounge of where you work are unconstitutional. This is utterly no different, and it's important to recognize the modesty of the requirement here is nothing more than a requirement to print out or have generally available, provided for free, a notice to put on the wall in prominent places. That doesn't purport to be the employer's communication, purports to be a communication by the U.S. government informing people of their rights. So let me give the I'll try to do it quickly, at least a flavor of the argument for why this is authorized. The premise is that, you know, certainly ignorance of the law is no excuse, but nobody's ever argued that it's a good thing and that the public policies of the country are furthered by failing to try to educate people about what the law is. The other side's position, stripped down, is that Congress has made an affirmative decision here that ignorance here is a sort of good thing, that educating people about their rights and utilizing regulatory powers otherwise granted to do so somehow is an affront to the balance of this act. And there's really not a shred of evidence of that. We'll talk about the legislative history materials he cited, which I think are very, very weak. And I'm reminded in a case overwhelmingly based on legislative history being made to conservatives, it strikes me as a little peculiar given that conservatives have often argued, Justice Scalia being most prominent, that the highly unreliable nature of legislative history evidence, and here it's among the weakest that I've ever seen. Judge Lowenthal in the D.C. Circuit once described legislative history arguments as too often looking over a crowded room and picking out your friends, and that really is the principal one that he cited was a Railway Labor Act provision, which is a different act, and although the two acts were passed somewhat contemporaneously, and they both have to do with labor relations, they're different in a host of ways. The notice provision he talked about is a provision that goes way beyond requiring notice. It's not a notice provision like the one here. It's a notice provision that says not only that you have to post notices, but that also you have to include the text of the act in individual employment contracts, and one of the reasons for that is that there's no NLRB in the Railway Labor Act, and that its provisions are enforced overwhelmingly through contract enforcement mechanisms and grievance procedure mechanisms, and that the contracts are required to include this, the text of various provisions of the Act. Well, this is a very different enforcement scheme, and the notion that they didn't borrow that is really hardly any evidence at all. But moreover, the law is quite clear that there is a provision that grants rulemaking authority, that the text of Section 6 is quite broad. It says the board shall have the authority from time to time to make, amend, and rescind in the manner prescribed by the APA such rules and regulations as may be necessary. Supreme Court case law interpreting that very similar language in other statutes says necessary in this context means reasonably related to the purposes of the enabling legislation. The purposes of the enabling legislation are set out in very broad terms. Conservatives don't like this act, and the social milieu that created this act is a tremendous controversy, but it is a historic fact what happened. And Congress was faced with vast industrial chaos in the country, massive strike situations, massive, the Great Depression with tremendous chaos. And it saw, rightly or wrongly, we may like it or dislike it, it saw this act as part of the remedy of that situation, of saying unregulated labor relations in which efforts to suppress unions were perfectly lawful and efforts to suppress worker organization perfectly lawful had led, in its judgment, maybe right, maybe wrong, to a chaotic economy and an economy that was in depression. And the Act specifically says that the goal of the mechanisms of the Act were to eliminate the causes of that situation, to eliminate the obstructions to interstate commerce that suppression of union activity represented, to encourage these procedures, to protect workers who exercise them, and to spread the benefits of that regime throughout the economy to prevent the disruptions in the economy as a whole. It's hard to take that and say that they meant that there was like an evil of government trying to educate people as to the availability of these mechanisms. The notion that this is a passive agency that is reactive makes perfect sense in that context in one way and not in another. It was an agency set up to resolve labor disputes, and in that regard, making its mechanisms available to people engaged in labor disputes was the essence of the Act. It was not supposed to go out and cause trouble where there was no trouble. It was not to go out and disrupt peaceful labor relations where there was none, but to allow people to utilize its mechanisms when the need arose was the very purpose of the Act, and was the policy was to make those mechanisms as widely available as possible. For a rule to say you have to post notice letting people know that this exists and that it's available is hardly revolutionary, and it's certainly not in conflict with the structure of the Act or with the goals of the Act. Indeed, there is a Supreme Court case in which this argument was raised previously, saying the board must be rigorously passive and rigorously reactive, a case called Nash-Finch, in which the board felt that the structure and efficacy of the Act was threatened by state governmental actions and initiated on its own basis suits for injunction in that regard. And the Supreme Court said that the reactive nature of the board does not disable it. It has implied powers to defend and promote the efficacy of the structure that Congress created. Now, there was no enabling statutory provision to even say that it could do what it was doing. Here there is. Section 6 says it can make rules. Indeed, if one wants to talk about legislative history, in 1947, in the more conservative, more pro-employer revisions, they tried to cut back on the previously largely unused Section 6 and say it can't be used for prospective substantive rulemaking. And that was defeated, and it was reenacted in the Act. Another piece of, I guess, legislative history is the Fair Labor Standards Act, which was also passed without any notice provision. But if you go into your company lounge, you'll see a notice posting talking about the minimum wage law. And the reason is because, just like here, the Department of Labor enacted such a requirement half a century ago through rulemaking no different than this. And it's never been challenged because everybody understands that it's a minimal burden and that it serves a function. And I don't think this does anything other than that. So there's plenty more to be said, but let me stop now and open it up for questions. Thank you very much.
Well, and I wonder if I could respond briefly.
Yes, I apologize. I didn't mean to.
That's okay. Just to clarify some things I said and some things I didn't say, because the issue here is not about whether the government has the right to try to, or the board has the right to try to educate workers. In fact, the board has created its own website using that newfangled internet thing to get the word out directly to people, which no one apparently has challenged. What's at issue here is the right and the statutory authority for the board to force employers in their own workplaces to do what the board apparently thinks is its job, and force them to do it, and force them to communicate with their employees a message which they may not share, or certainly may not share in the way that it's been framed by the board. It should be mentioned that there were thousands of public comments filed in response to the original proposed rule, thousands of which decried the evident bias in the language of the notice poster that the employers are being told to communicate to their employees. So just want to clarify, it's not about education. It's about who's going to be compelled to do the educating. And the issue was brought up, I only had a chance to mention at the beginning, the Railway Labor Act, because that was the starting point. But and this goes to the point that Mr. Cammiott made about how there are all those other notice posters on the walls of many employers. In every one of those statutes, other than, and we'll talk about it, the Fair Labor Standards Act, every one of those posters derives from express statutory authorization. The NLRB is unique in being structured as this reactive agency, not given affirmative authority to require employers to do things until the employers do something wrong. And in the Fair Labor Standards Act, even there, the Congress, when they enacted the law, gave the Department of Labor, in that case, all kinds of affirmative obligations that they could impose on employers, and which the Act imposed on employers, to create reports, to be audited, investigated, and the notice posting that went along with that was mild by comparison with other things that they were already required to do. Also can't really speak to why it wasn't challenged at the time, but it might not have succeeded because of those very features which are nowhere present in the National Labor Relations Act. And the board is really unique. I can't say it strongly enough. And when I brought up 8C, it was not, although I don't reject the possible First Amendment argument, but what I brought up 8C about, 8C of the National Labor Relations Act that was put in by Taft-Hartley, it goes beyond the First Amendment. It is unique to the National Labor Relations Act. There's not a single other form of labor legislation that included a provision that said that the enforcement agency could not regulate the communications of employers with their employees. That is explicit language which all by itself eliminates the possibility of the board imposing this notice requirement, which is why it's not even necessary to reach the question of legislative history. But in fact, legislative history is one of the tools of construction that the Supreme Court has said should be used in determining whether an agency has the right to exercise some claimed authority like this one. And in fact, it's pretty powerful. The courts that have looked at this, certainly the South Carolina court, thought it was almost determinative. And there's a strong D.C. Circuit opinion that have said that when Congress has put certain type of language in many other similar statutes and yet has chosen not to do it in the one that's at issue, that is strong evidence. That's the words of the D.C. Circuit. Strong evidence that they intended not to authorize the agency to do what is being challenged, and that's exactly the situation here. There are significant reasons why the board was not given that authority. The actual language of the statute is critical. This act is not silent on the issue at hand. And let me just clarify one last thing, which is that I did not say that rulemaking is not a permissible way for the board to do something that it is authorized to do. What I may have heard Mr. Kamiat say is that the board somehow has greater power in the rulemaking process than it does in any other provision of the Act, when all that Section 6 says is that the board can do what's necessary to carry out the provisions of the Act. The provisions of the Act, including Section 8, 9, and 10 of the Act, all restrict the authority of the board to impose affirmative obligations on employers, except as remedies for things that they have done. And there's not a single other case, including some that were referenced without us getting into, you know, names of cases that none of you have ever heard of, it's not a single other case where the board has been allowed to impose a broad prospective action, obligation like this one, without remedying something that employers had done. Here, employers have not done anything, the 6 million that are affected, and yet they are having this thing thrust upon them. So the point that has been made by the business community in this whole business is that the board can't do more through rulemaking than it was entitled to do through adjudication. And I don't mean procedural versus substantive. That's not the issue. There could be substantive rules that are consistent with the provisions of the Act. But the board cannot escape from the restrictions that have been placed on it. And if it is allowed to, and that's why this is such a big deal, if the board's allowed to do this, then it's going to be limitless in its authority. And there are cases of the D.C. Circuit that have so held. Just by way of example, reports, there's nothing in the National Labor Relations Act that prohibits or directs the board about requiring reports of employers. That, until now, has been felt to be evidence and proof that the board is not allowed to require these kind of reports, for example, that the Fair Labor Standards Act requires. Well, what's going to stop them from doing it? Or even sticking with this notion of educating employees, can the board next require employers to somehow prove that they have properly educated their employees, conduct training classes to educate the employees, allow the union in to conduct these classes? It's really not. I wish I could say that these are far-fetched notions. It used to be viewed as far-fetched that the board would impose a notice posting requirement on the 6 million employers after 77 years of not having done so and not being allowed to do so. So, again, and maybe now you want to respond to those things, but we can also open it up to the questions.
I promised, if I can, to be very, very, very brief, but I do think I need to respond to some of that.
Mr. Kamiat, this is Gene Reuter breaking in just for a second.
Yep.
Let me open the floor to questions so people can begin to join the queue. I'll give you a chance to respond before we take a question, but let me break in here just very briefly. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question, if you want to join the conversation, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone.
But I will be able to respond briefly.
So people can begin lining up for questions by pushing star and pound. And with that, now let's go back to Walter Kamiat for his brief response.
Okay, I'll try to be very brief. First, the characterization here that this is forcing employers to communicate messages to their employees that they do not believe in. Nobody in the universe could possibly construe this requirement as a requirement that employers profess to believe anything. A requirement that one post a government notice is not a requirement to engage in speech on your own behalf, which is what Section 8C protects. And that distinction between a requirement to post government notices and a requirement to say things you do not choose to say on your own behalf is a well-understood distinction in the law. And the difference between government speech and private speech and the burden on the government to make clear that its requirements are government speech is well, well understood. And there is no law that I have ever heard of under 8C or under the First Amendment that equates the two and says that the sanctity of free speech means that in a regulated setting, you can't be required to post a government notice. Secondly, the issue of the reactive nature of the board and that if this paired with the issue that if you allow this, anything's possible. it is entirely consistent with a board being reactive and a board being available to resolve disputes to have a requirement that people have to be told about the existence of the law on the board. That's not in conflict with having a basic reactive structure. And if one goes to the words of the statute, there's nothing in there that says the rulemaking authority is limited, that it may not require anybody to do anything outside of the unfair labor practice procedures or outside of the representation procedures. That was akin to the 1947 amendment that was rejected. It is a rulemaking requirement to ensure the effective operation of the act. And it's not unlimited. Judgment may be needed to establish its limits, just like the Necessary and Proper Clause in the Constitution or similar provisions elsewhere. This is narrowly tailored. It's using a very minimally burdensome and well-understood method of simply having to post something on a bulletin board. And indeed, while it is true that most federal regimes that have notice posting requirements are in statute, as most of those are subsequent to this, they're not predecessors to this, and the big exception is the Fair Labor Standards Act, which has never been challenged nor caused controversy in this regard. And in fact, I would point out that there is also a vast body of state law. State employment notices are required, and those often are exactly structured in the form here, where there is not a statutory requirement. There is simply an authorization of the agency to promulgate rules, maybe narrow rules, to facilitate the operation of the statute, and they've done so through, among other things, a notice posting. In terms of the rulemaking process that went on, It absolutely showed vast employer opposition to this, which I think is unfortunate. It also showed vast employer opposition to unionization, and in many employer comments, very militant employer comments, they oppose this rule on the basis that they have a right to keep unions out of their workplace, union activity out of their workplace, communications about unions out of their workplace, which of course is completely contrary to this law. Rather than undercut the ability of the board to do a rulemaking, that kind of commentary vividly illustrates, whether one likes the law or not, that there's a crying need to educate the public about the nature of this law, since rarely do you have rulemaking comments that are blatant admissions of an intention to violate the law, often reflecting no understanding of what the law is. So that comment history far more supports this rulemaking than undercuts it. And the rulemaking, why 77 years later, it's a very different world than it was in 1935. In 1935, everybody knew about this. The whole country was brought to a standstill through massive strike activities, and the issues here were vastly well known. It may have been Congress, we don't know. It may have been Congress. There's no legislative history, even a debate about notice posting at the time. There's certainly no legislative history or statutory language that frowns on notice posting. And Congress may have said this is an agency about to be inundated with disputes, given a massive general strike in North Carolina. There's a general strike in San Francisco. There's a general strike in Minneapolis. There's taking over of steel mills and auto plants. The last thing we want to burden them is the first thing they have to do is make sure everybody posts notices to get more cases. It's not irrational to say under that circumstance, you make a judgment whether the act needs or doesn't need this, and I do deplore that they took 77 years to come around to it, but the notion that they have permanently barred from making that judgment with changes so that today the law is not widely well known and it is being widely abused seems like a reasonable agency judgment of the kind that the law allows agencies to make. Okay, I'm done. Well, thank you.
Great. Thank you, gentlemen. Thank you both. Once again, to our audience, if you want to join the conversation, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Our lines are open. We have one caller question. Before we go to that caller, let me give our regular programming announcement here. We've got three Teleform conference calls on the schedule for next week. On Tuesday, we'll have a special Courthouse Steps edition of Teleform. as our expert reports from the oral argument on the Prop 8 decision being argued on Tuesday. That call will be Tuesday at 1 p.m. On Wednesday, another Courthouse Steps edition of Teleforum, as the DOMA case will be argued. That also on Wednesday at 1 p.m., both those calls Tuesday and Wednesday at 1 p.m. Then on Thursday, we'll be looking at the Horn case. That's the raisin growers case, sort of a property rights takings case, Thursday at 1 o'clock next week. All three calls next week. As always, check the Federalist Society website for an update on our calendar. We've got one caller question, then our lines are open. You need to push star and then pound on your telephone if you have a question. Let's go now to our first caller.
John Rowland, Constitution.org. What is the precise language in the Act which would authorize the board to issue regulations that apply to parties that do not have cases before the board?
Let us know who's responding, and then go right ahead and respond, if you could.
Okay, I'm trying to find the exact text of Section 6. Section 6 simply says, should have it in front of me. The board shall have the authority from time to time to make, amend, and rescind in the manner prescribed by the Administrative Procedure Act such rules and regulations as may be necessary to carry out the provisions of this act. No limitation. The limitation is, does it carry out the provisions of this act? And setting a background rule that will only be adjudicated in the context of the act's pre-existing adjudicative processes, which are the reactive processes that are being discussed, seems that that pretty explicitly says that they can do that.
And actually, it doesn't.
Well, and this is Maury Baskin again, that the limitation is that it has to be necessary to carry out the provisions of the Act. And the provisions of the Act include the statement in Section 10A of the Act that the board is, which describes the powers of the board, states explicitly the board is empowered only as hereinafter provided in Section 10, which is the section that makes it very clear that the board can only react to charges brought by private parties and complaints filed and then the general counsel, or petitions for elections by the union. It cannot reach out, and nothing in Section 6 gives it rights beyond those that are already in Section 10 and then the limitations of Section 8. Section 10 is used to enforce Section 8. Those remain in place, and the notion that Section 6 gives this unlicensed or unlimited new authority, and that has been raised by the board in the arguments as they've progressively gone through them and sort of been backed into a corner a little bit on some of this, because the Supreme Court has so clearly restricted the board from doing this kind of thing in a case-by-case analysis, that the board attorney made the claim that, well, gosh, we could declare today that every employer in the country is interfering with their employees' rights right now, and that really shocked the court, I think. And that in essence is what is being argued here today in support of. And I just don't think that it can fly under the clear, plain language of the Act, which does limit the board's authority.
Can you give me the plain language? I'm looking at Section 10 now. Section 10 describes the unfair labor practice processes. I'm not saying the board can do anything it wants, and I'm not necessarily – I was at the oral argument, and I don't think that's what was said. But if that was what was said, I'm not supporting that either. But, Nash Finch said the board can proactively act on its own in a certain context because of implied power. Section 6 is not an implied power. It's an express power. Why have a rulemaking authority if you can't do anything under rulemaking authority you could have done without rulemaking authority?
But rulemaking authority has to be consistent with the statutory authority. And so the rulemaking can make substantive changes only as necessary to carry out the provisions of the Act. It's the statute that takes priority. So you can't say that the rule allows you to create new rights, new unfair labor practices, for example, just by using the language of Section 6. In fact, the D.C. Circuit has decided several cases interpreting the Supreme Court case that you mentioned, as you know, that says that, well, having that general language isn't enough if you don't have statutory authority in the first place. And that's what's lacking. The Congress did not give the board the authority to do this. And the notion that it's a different world, we've heard that argued, it's said in the rulemaking itself. I was struck by the fact that there was a question actually asked in the argument in the D.C. Circuit of the board attorney. What was the actual percentage of unionization back in the 30s compared to now? It turns out she didn't actually answer the question. It wasn't known at that moment, but turns out it was about the same.
Private sector unionization was much higher actually back then.
Not so.
Bureau
of Labor Statistics chart on the internet.
I've seen the statistics, and I think it's not true. Private sector unionization was much higher back then.
But surely you won't deny. We'll just agree to disagree about that. Okay. But you won't deny that the percentage of unionization increased steadily over the years with no notice posting requirement. Clearly, was not necessary for it to happen.
And yet here
in a world where you have massive amounts of information being distributed over the internet, where many more people get their information from the internet than they do from the lounge in the workplace, that is not the way in which the board should have proceeded. That the notion that they have to go to employers and force them to post this kind of notice, that this is necessary to educate workers or to somehow make this information available, when anyone can go online right now and punch in a few random words about workers or employee rights, and they'll be flooded with information, much more detailed, in fact, than what the board has put in.
I don't want to bore everybody with a discussion of Section 10, which is quite long. I don't see any language in Section 10 that describe any limits on Section 6. I agree with you that the board cannot use Section 6 to do things wildly or even moderately in conflict with the rest of the Act. To say that an authorization to enact rules, which substantive rules are the ability to impose prospective obligations, that is in fact, or prospective prohibitions, that is in fact the definition of a rule, to say that you can't, that a rule that says you can enact rules as reasonably needed, which is reasonably related to effectuate the purpose of the Act, which was what Morning said, that's what necessary means. In a regime that is dependent on people knowing their rights and bringing them to the board, which is the structure that you point to, and in a statute that says in very explicit statutory language that the purpose of that mechanism is to restructure the nation's economy so as to ensure that that people have these rights readily available should they choose to use them, in that regime, to have a requirement that people be told of the rights and to provide the notice that nobody has to guess about how to do it, they just post a notice the government gives you, to say that's an outlandish, radical step, not in my mind.
All right, gentlemen, we've got another caller with a question. If you want to get in the queue for a question as an audience member, you need to push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's take another question now.
Hi, this is Glenn Taubman at the National Right to Work Foundation, and I've been involved in some of the briefing in this case, so I have to say that up front. And my question, which I guess is for Mr. Kamiat, is I want to ask about the penalties that are created by the rules that are levied against non-compliant employers. And I guess my question is, wouldn't you agree as a labor lawyer that it was a gross overreach by the board to try to create a penalty that extended the 10B period and that created an animus penalty for unfair labor practices that aren't even related to the failure to post? And, I mean, how in the world do they justify that? And I'm asking you if you can justify that.
Okay, that's a fair question. So I guess I read the rule, and I read some of the defense of the rule, and I read some of the criticism of the rule, and to me, this is my own personal view, there's a little disconnect in some of it. What I understand the rule to be, and if I'm wrong, I'm wrong, but whether I'm right or wrong, it seems to me that it should be upheld at least on that basis, is, and this is, you know, it was said that the district court in D.C. overturned the rule in certain respects. It's a peculiar overturning because it overturned the rule in it, and I think this is what you're referring to, in construing the rule as flatly stating that the failure to post a notice equals an unfair labor practice in all cases, or that the failure to post a notice equals a basis for tolling the statute of limitations in all cases. They said that's not permitted. I actually don't read the rule as saying that. So I'm generally happy with at least what I understand the district court opinion to say is permitted, which is to say that where you've refused to post a notice and there's evidence that that's interfered with people's ability to exercise their rights or access the board in a statute that says it's unlawful to interfere with those rights or processes, that equals interference. That's what I think they were driving at in the district court, saying that it's not a per se violation. And I guess, you know, that seems not, you know, I'm happy with that arrangement, whether the board could have or did go further. I'm happy with that arrangement in terms of tolling, to show as an element of a tolling case that the failure to post notice, you know, that there's an effect on the person's knowledge and ability to bring the action. I'm happy with that arrangement, whether the board could or did go further, and maybe I should try to defend going further, but for sustaining it, I'm happy with that arrangement. And in terms of the anti-union animus, if where an employer refuses to post the notice, knowing of its obligation, to say that that is an inference of an anti-union animus, there's no prohibition against anti-union animus. It's an element in a proof of motive for certain actions, and to say that that can be used as evidence of that seems to me to be a reasonable judgment. I would also point out that you have notice posting obligations which are viewed as obligations that are unassociated with particular penalties, and I think there's a D.C. Circuit case that says you evaluate the imposition of an obligation and whether it's authorized or not separately from evaluating the particular penalties that are ascribed to it. I think they've ascribed three potential penalties, all of which are limited to the traditional reactive processes that Mr. Baskin refers to. The way the board works, by the way, is that complaints are not issued unless there's a judgment that there's a real need to issue a complaint to further the purposes of the act. So where somebody just didn't post the notice, if somebody and by mistake or whatever, and is willing once the obligation is brought to them to post the notice, if a complaint is raised, I can't imagine actually a charge or any penalty being assessed other than at most an order to post the notice, which if the person was willing has already been done. And more than likely, they wouldn't even issue such an order if the person was willing to post the notice after the obligation was flagged for them.
And this is Maury Baskin. I don't have a lot to add to that in response, because I think except to say the district court opinion left the law more jumbled than ever, because it leaves employers with no guidance at all as to when they're going to be punished and what they're going to be punished for. That was better than the board's original way overbroad dictate that they would just be punished. But still, both outcomes are wrong in terms of the statutory requirements. So I guess I'll leave it there.
All right. We have one more caller question at this point, and we've got about 5 minutes. So let's go to our next caller.
John Rowland, Constitution.org again. Does not this requirement conflict with the anti-commandeering this precedent in Prince?
If I'm understanding, the anti-commandeering is about state sovereignty. I'm missing something here. Where's the state sovereignty issue here?
By implication, it would also extend to private individuals.
Well, that would be a revolutionary constitutional principle that the federal government can't tell private individuals to do things?
That's right. They can't.
Well, I think there was a constitutional convention in 1787 that made a contrary decision.
No, they only authorized Congress to make certain laws. If the law doesn't say you have to do something, an administrative agency or quasi-judicial organ can't do it.
Well, I understand the argument. I do not think that that has been the law ever. And I am aware of no cases that say administrative agencies cannot promulgate rules that make people do things. And I would hazard to guess that Mr. Baskin wouldn't say that that's law either.
Well, actually, I was going to say that there's a little ellipse there left out at the end of what you just said, because the administrative agencies can only order people to do things when they have statutory authority to make those orders.
And that's what
that
we're disputing.
That brings us full circle, of course, back to what we were talking about.
That if the statute is construed the way I argued, obviously if it's construed the way you argue, you win. If it's construed the way I argue, I win. But it's not. But that construction that I'm advocating would not be an unconstitutional construction, which is, I think, what the question is hazarding.
And I'm not sure, frankly, how that plays out. It was not argued in the court that way, so
Would the questioner believe that, maybe he would, that the Fair Labor Standards Act notice, the OSHA notice, the Title VII notice, the cigarette packaging notice, the et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, are all unconstitutional?
That's right. They are.
Okay.
Well, gentlemen, we've got about 3 minutes left. Let me see if you each want to take a very brief, so we can end on time, opportunity to express any final thoughts. Just 60 seconds each, if we could stick to that, I think we can get this done. Why don't we have Mr. Walter Kamiot go first, if you could.
Okay. I mean, I think I've said most of what I want, but let me point out, this has been described as an onerous or autocratic or whatever overstep in regulation. I think, you know, the National Labor Relations Act has been on the books for 77 years, and it is still a very widely misunderstood law. Probably one of the hugest areas of misunderstanding is that a large number of people, both employees and employers, don't fully understand what's required of it, don't fully understand the rights at issue. The most glaring example, which has been well documented, is that non-union employees have substantial rights to engage in concerted activity completely in the absence of unions, and to discuss, for example, their wages, their benefits, their workplace grievances with each other, as well as engage in certain protest activities, free from threat of discharge, et cetera. That's widely not understood. Many employers, not knowing they're violating the law, take actions to prohibit such discussions or prohibit such activities, much less prohibited actions relating to union activities. This not only educates employees, it also educates employers. And the comments made show that there's widespread confusion in both communities, to the extent that having the notice educates people as to not making unintentional violations of the law. It accomplishes tremendous public good avoiding lots of litigation, lots of administrative proceedings that is unnecessary. in hearing the rhetoric.
We need to wrap up.
Okay, this last sentence. In hearing the rhetoric, I have to say, what really comes through is those who oppose this rule. There's always been a controversial law, and those who oppose this rule really imbue their rhetoric with a hostility to the rights represented in the Act and to the effective operation of the Act, and to say the under-enforcement of the norms of the Act are in essence a good thing and an employer prerogative. I don't say that's the explicit argument, but that seems to underspeak it. And, you know, that is a legitimate view, but I'm not sure it's a view that the law should recognize.
Okay, Maury Baskin, final thought.
Just very briefly, the only view that I'm expressing here today is that the rule of law is what's at stake here, and that the misunderstanding that's going on is the misunderstanding by the board of its authority and an effort that has really become clear over the last couple of years by the appointees, recent appointees to the board, who generally have come from the union backgrounds, to expand the board's authority beyond the original understandings of the statute, and certainly as that statute was amended, and as it had been understood to be for decades. But with that, I'd certainly want to thank the Federalist Society, and thank you, Mr. Cammiott, for a spirited discussion this afternoon.
And I agree, and I want to thank everybody very, very much. It was a lot of fun. Thanks so much.
Thanking both Mr. Maurice Baskin and Mr. Walter Cammiott for joining us today. To the audience, I invite you to join us for our next special Courthouse Steps edition of Teleform next Tuesday at 1 p.m. at this same number, when we'll be discussing the Prop 8 oral argument. But until then, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.